So why did Lucy and her kind come down from the trees and out of the forests? Probably they had no choice. The slow rise of the Isthmus of Panama had cut the flow of waters from the Pacific into the Atlantic, diverting warming currents away from the Arctic and leading to the onset of an exceedingly sharp ice age in northern latitudes. In Africa, this would have produced seasonal drying and cooling, gradually turning jungle into savanna. It was not so much that Lucy and her like left the forests, John Gribbon has written, but that the forests left them. But stepping out onto the open savanna also clearly left the early hominids much more exposed. An upright hominid could see better, but could also be seen better. Even now, as a species, we are almost preposterously vulnerable in the wild. Nearly every large animal you can care to name is stronger, faster, and toothier than us. Faced with attack, modern humans have only two advantages. We have a good brain with which we can devise strategies, and we have hands with which we can fling or brandish hurtful objects. We are the only creature that can harm at a distance. We can thus afford to be physically vulnerable. All the elements would appear to have been in place for the rapid evolution of a potent brain, and yet that seems not to have happened. For over 3 million years, Lucy and her fellow Australopithecines scarcely changed at all. Their brain didn't grow, and there is no sign that they used even the simplest tools. What is stranger still is that we now know that for about 1 million years, they lived alongside other early hominids who did use tools, yet the Australopithecines never took advantage of this useful technology that was all around them. At one point, between 3 and 2 million years ago, it appears there may have been as many as 6 hominid types coexisting in Africa. Only one, however, was fated to last, Homo, which emerged from the mists beginning about 2 million years ago. No one knows quite what the relationship was between Australopithecines and Homo, but what is known is that they coexisted for something over 1 million years before all the Australopithecines, robust and gracile alike, vanished mysteriously, and possibly abruptly over 1 million years ago. No one knows why they disappeared. Perhaps, suggests Matt Ridley, we ate them. Conventionally, the Homo line begins with Homo habilis, a creature about whom we know almost nothing, and concludes with us. Homo sapiens, literally man the thinker. In between, and depending on which opinions you value, there have been half a dozen other Homo species. Homo ergaster, Homo neanderthalensis, Homo rudolfensis, Homo heidelbergensis, Homo erectus, and Homo antecessor. Homo habilis, handyman, was named by Lewis Leakey and colleagues in 1964, and was so called because it was the first hominid to use tools, albeit very simple ones. It was a fairly primitive creature, much more chimpanzee than human, but its brain was about 50% larger than that of Lucy in gross terms, and not much less large proportionally, so it was the Einstein of its day. No persuasive reason has ever been advanced for why hominid brains suddenly began to grow 2 million years ago. For a long time it was assumed that big brains and upright walking were directly related, that the movement out of the forests necessitated cunning new strategies that fed off of or promoted braininess. So it was something of a surprise, after the repeated discoveries of so many bipedal dullards, to realize that there was no apparent connection between them at all. There is simply no compelling reason we know of to explain why human brains got large, says Tattersall. Huge brains are demanding organs. They make up only 2% of the body's mass, but devour 20% of its energy. They are also comparatively picky in what they use as fuel. If you never ate another morsel of fat, your brain would not complain because it won't touch the stuff. It wants glucose instead, and lots of it, even if it means short-changing other organs. As Guy Brown notes, the body is in constant danger of being depleted by a greedy brain, but cannot afford to let the brain go hungry, as that would rapidly lead to death. A big brain needs more food, and more food means increased risk. Tattersall thinks the rise of a big brain may simply have been an evolutionary accident. He believes, with Stephen Jay Gould, that if you replayed the tape of life, even if you ran it back only a relatively short way to the dawn of hominids, the chances are quite unlikely that modern humans or anything like them would be here now. One of the hardest ideas for humans to accept, he says, is that we are not the culmination of anything. There is nothing inevitable about our being here. It is part of our vanity as humans that we tend to think of evolution as a process that, in effect, was programmed to produce us. Even anthropologists tended to think this way right up until the 1970s. Indeed, as recently as 1991, in the popular textbook The Stages of Evolution, C. Loring Brace stuck doggedly to the linear concept, acknowledging just one evolutionary dead end, the robust Australopithecines. Everything else represented a straightforward progression, each species of hominid carrying the baton of development so far, then handing it on to a younger, fresher runner. Now, however, it seems certain that many of these early forms followed side trails that didn't come